The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
But you know, she was single for a long time after her grad. Right.
And then she had somebody.
The Takeaway staff is pretty excited about the split between Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, as you can hear. But we're going to get you the real news here in a second. This is the Takeaway podcast for Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. And if you like the show, could you do us a favor and go to iTunes or anywhere else that you get your podcasts and give us a rating? Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A fingerprint, some tips, cell phone data, questioning of individuals who noticed a change in the personality of a 28-year-old, Ahmed Khan Rahami, after a visit to Afghanistan. And Rahami was the man captured yesterday in Linden, New Jersey, in connection with a series of bombings across New York City metro area over the weekend. City officials emphasized that the investigation remains active. According to reports, Rahami is a U.S. citizen of Afghan descent, born in Afghanistan. He was not on any terror watch list, but he was swiftly apprehended, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said, due to some classic by-the-book police work.
Our people handled this crisis from moment one with strength and resilience. And it was so impressive that people were back to business yesterday and today. In addition, of course, the president offered his congratulations to our first responders for all they had done.
New York Mayor de Blasio at a news conference yesterday. So what do we know here? And maybe more importantly, what don't we know? Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Welcome, Karen.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dawn Scalise is the government global business director at Thomson Reuters. She's a career CIA officer and a member of BEN's Business Executives for National Security. Dawn, welcome to you.
Hello, I'm happy to join you.
So what's your gut, both of you, on this case here? Great job. Do we need to find out a lot more before we can draw any conclusions, Karen?
Well, we do need to find out more before we can draw conclusions. The gut reaction is, I think, what the mayor said, which is that law enforcement and intelligence agents tracked this down very quickly, seemed to know exactly what they were doing. The larger question is, did he act alone, and what's coming in the future? What does this have to do with a larger plan, if anything? This is the first individual from an ISIS attack in this country that's been apprehended alive. So we actually, law enforcement can actually ask him questions and find these things out and see what else is coming or who else was involved.
Dawn, your impressions?
I agree it's a little bit early to be able to draw conclusions about specific motivation, but certainly we saw clear acts of terrorism regardless of whether or not they were specifically directed or inspired from abroad. But certainly we're seeing increasing focus on these groups, really helping to inspire those to do acts of terrorism in place. And increasingly, we see those who are self-motivated and self-radicalized to act, unfortunately.
Now, what's the prosecutorial strategy in a case like this, Dawn? And Karen, you probably have a view on this as well. They've got him charged with attempted murder of officers. Now, can they just proceed with those charges and keep him in custody indefinitely? Or do they have to disclose any additional investigation associated with conspiracy, affiliation with ISIS, the results of interrogations that may lead various places in this national security realm? Could that all remain below board, or do they have to disclose all of it, Dawn?
You know, I'm not the specifics of how law enforcement, the FBI in particular, will approach this right now, but certainly they have clear grounds for indictment presently in terms of the threat he posed and the attempts against the life of the law enforcement officers, even while, as Karen said, they can question him and try to learn more about whether or not he had any linkages to other individuals here domestically or abroad that provided specific direction or inspiration for the attacks. No doubt there's any number of strategies that law enforcement can pursue at this point in time, but it's clear that they're going to want the time to be able to get additional information so that they more fully understand, you know, any support that he may have and the motivation behind the attempted attacks, and as well as, of course, the attack that occurred in Chelsea.
Karen, do those revelations unfold in public, or are they part of some secret investigation that we may never know about?
I think we're going to know about it. I think we're going to see federal terrorism charges. We're going to see a series of material support charges. Once they get their facts together, that's what they're going to want to charge him with. It's just a matter of time. They'll have a superseding indictment from this initial complaint, and we'll see what happens, whether he pleads or goes to trial.
Now, it was discussed yesterday that this was by the book police work, but I'm wondering if it's actually by the new book, in the sense that this is a post 9/11 example of interagency cooperation that these groups in the United States seem to be very practiced with, unlike what we've seen in Europe, where the interagency cooperation was non-existent. Karen?
Yeah, there's no doubt there's more interagency cooperation, but you can the NYPD and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which have been working together very well, particularly of late, had their act together on this one. Let's also remember that these were smaller incidents than we might have expected and than we're seeing in Europe as well. This was Chelsea. This wasn't Times Square.
Right.
And part of that is a result of law enforcement having such a presence in the larger populated centers that it was in a more contained place. At least that's what I think. And so it's both strategy and cooperation.
Do you think this was a practice run for this fellow, Mr. Rahami, Don?
You know, it's unclear, but certainly we see, you know, both with the incident with Rahami as well as with other incidents of late within the United States, certainly a focus on soft targets, targets that the perpetrator may know, understand that they can penetrate and operate in with ease. And so I think we're going to continue to see that. It's unclear whether or not this was specifically a dry run for perhaps a larger attack in a more iconic setting. But I think increasingly we're seeing attempts at softer targets just because they're certainly easier to carry out and perhaps with less scrutiny at the time.
So the main information that they're going to want from Rahami is what's the real target, right?
If there is such a thing, what they're going to want to know from him is who are his contacts? Was he in contact with anybody? Was he, as Don said, self-radicalized? Was he self-educated about how to build this bomb? What did all those trips to Pakistan mean? So they will want to know. But there has been no leakage in the press that this might have been a practice run. I would choose the interpretation that it's more terrorists trying to act where they can act and that the venues are becoming increasingly hard to choose. And so...
So let me turn this around to Don and Karen. This is a ragtag, you know, sort of hobby in the basement kind of pressure cooker crackpot who spends a lot of money on plane tickets to Pakistan. And, you know, to equate him as a huge national security threat to the United States is utter buffoonery and plays into ISIS's propaganda goals. Don, what would you say?
You know, I would say that even before ISIS, when you saw with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the instructions that they released some years back in Inspire magazine, instructions on how to put together pipe bombs and pressure cooker bombs and the like, and we saw this play out with the Sarnaya brothers, certainly in Boston, there's an increased focus in enabling those who adhere to al-Qaeda or to ISIL's ideology to carry out attacks in their own backyard.
But are these jihadi Boy Scouts who are just sort of signing up for something that they saw online, or is it some organized army?
You know, I certainly wouldn't call it an organized army. Certainly, I think that the mantra almost now oftentimes is just to do it, to carry out attacks in areas where you live, using easy targets as well as weaponry that is easy to acquire or to put together, as in the case with these bombs. And certainly, Rahami did not show a great deal of skill in putting them together or in the placement of the bombs, but it could have gone far differently. So it's certainly not clear that he received any training to do this, but there certainly are training instructions and other types of instructions that are available through the web and through various terrorist websites and the like. So unfortunately, I think we're going to continue to see these kinds of attempts, whether or not they're highly successful or not.
Karen?
Yeah, I think that we have to draw a real distinction between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It is possible that these ISIS individuals, type individuals, will morph into an organized command structure. But right now, that's not what we see. These are largely self-radicalized. There's 110 cases right now, prosecutions of ISIS-inspired individuals in the United States. And they are, it's sort of a passive inspiration. It often overlaps with some kind of personal agenda, personal disappointment, personal exclusion from society. So I think we're seeing something extremely different than Al-Qaeda. And I think the use of pressure cookers in this attempt to try to make people think that ISIS is more like Al-Qaeda than it actually is.
But pressure cooker bombs go back to the Anarchist's Cookbook in 1971, right? I mean, they've been used in France in the 2000s. Maoists used them in Kashmir. We've seen them in Greece. They've been in the Palestine and the occupied territories in Israel. Pressure cooker bombs have no identity with ISIS, as far as we can tell.
Absolutely not. But in this country, they do have an identity with the Boston bombing and with the only successful attack of that nature since 9/11. And so that is, I think that was the symbolicness of it. Also, pressure cooker. The materials that you can get for a pressure cooker, as you can find out online, are actually very simple, won't cause any alerts with law enforcement. They're not on an ATF list. They're only lethal when they are combined. They're only powerful when they're combined. And so all of these things, pressure cooker, the two pieces of the compound, all of these things are so easy to obtain. So
pressure cooker watch list. That's what's next here in the United States. Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Dawn Scalise is government global business director at Thomson Reuters. She's a career CIA officer and a member of the Business Executives for National Security. Dawn and Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yesterday, Tulsa police released video of Friday's fatal shooting of Terrence Crutcher, a 40-year-old African-American man. Crutcher was unarmed, shot once at close range. It appeared he was moving backwards with his hands up. Police say he was acting erratically. In footage from a helicopter circling the scene, an officer is heard making a judgment about what he was seeing many feet below.
That looks like a bad dude, too, to be on something.
On Monday, the sister of that, quote, bad dude who might have been on something, Tiffany Crutcher, called for charges to be filed against the officer who killed her brother.
You all want to know who that big bad dude was? That big bad dude was my twin brother. That big bad dude was a father.
Joining us now is Matt Trotter, a reporter for KWGS Public Radio in Tulsa. Matt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
How is the sort of sense of community, nerves right now in Tulsa? I mean, there's a tense racial history in Tulsa that not a lot of people are aware of in America, but people in Tulsa are certainly aware of it. How are people feeling right now?
You know, you can feel a bit of that unrest sort of simmering under the surface. I talked to some protesters downtown yesterday morning, and their sense is they're going to let the justice system handle it. They're going to let the investigations play out, but they don't have complete trust in them. So there's a sense of if this doesn't go right, if they sense some sort of corruption or wrongdoing in it that gives a result they're not expecting, things might change.
What is the status of the officers in this incident who appear on the video? And that includes everybody, even the helicopter folks.
The only one I know of is Officer Betty Shelby, the one who actually fired. She's on paid leave, which is standard. The others, I don't know.
What history in Tulsa does this have? I mean, what is the status of trust between law enforcement and the African-American community in Tulsa, if you can describe such a thing?
I would say it's been shaken, definitely. Being sort of a newcomer to Tulsa myself, I've lived here 4 years. I don't have the entire history, of course, but I was here less than 18 months ago when another unarmed black man was shot and killed by a Tulsa law enforcement officer. And this was a volunteer sheriff's deputy who donated significant amounts of money and resources to the force. didn't have adequate training to be in the assignment that he was in. And the official line was he mistook his taser for his gun. He accidentally drew his gun and fired his gun rather than his taser while participating in a sting operation. Shot an unarmed man, and that man died. And just 4 months ago, that volunteer deputy received a four-month prison sentence for it, which many felt was not enough.
And what you're describing is kind of an eagerness on the part of certain members of the law enforcement community, or an eagerness on the part of Tulsa civilians to get involved in exciting events like SWAT, you know, stings, this sort of thing, and that bears on the issue of who's a cop and who's not a cop in Tulsa in some way?
You know, it's not common practice for civilians to, you know, join the police force as a volunteer or the sheriff's department as a volunteer and get involved in these things. The case that I was just talking about is sort of an outlier in all this. He received a bit of preferential treatment under the previous sheriff. But that led to a different kind of citizen involvement. We had an advocacy group called We the People Oklahoma that stepped forward to file a petition asking for a grand jury investigation of the sheriff's office. And while the deputy himself was being investigated for the shooting, the sheriff's department was also being investigated for things like inadequate training of their volunteers and misuse of resources. And ultimately led to a misdemeanor conviction of the previous sheriff.
How has the leadership of law enforcement in Tulsa been handling this? What's been their focus? It seems transparency has been pretty much front and center here.
Right, and transparency has been mentioned a couple times, both by civic leaders and community leaders and the police department. The police department put this video out yesterday, but they sort of had a closed-door session Sunday with community leaders and family members to show them the video. So they did that ahead of time before releasing it to the public. And the police chief's been on record as calling the video disturbing.
You know, I'm a lay person, and I'm probably putting you in an uncomfortable position. But again, the circumstances are puzzling. Why would you just and apparently backup had just arrived on the scene. Why would you pull the trigger in a situation like that? Is there any indication of circumstances that help to explain what happened on that video?
The only thing that we know right now is Officer Shelby's attorney says that she felt threatened under the circumstances. And I'm not sure whether that's their claim that he attempted to reach into the SUV, which you can't definitively tell from any of the video that's available, or callers saying that the man was acting erratically, the man that turned out to be Terrence Crutcher. And, you know, it's hard to say what exactly led up to it. We just don't have that information. We don't have that video footage. It doesn't exist.
But for now, anyway, there's a peace in Tulsa as both sides in this case, this disturbing case, as Matt Trotter describes, attempt to see how the circumstances will unfold. Matt, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
Matt Trotter is a reporter for KWGS Public Radio in Tulsa, and he's covering the case of Mr. Crutcher, Terrence Crutcher, a 40-year-old African-American who was shot on Friday, unarmed and at close range.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
When the actor Jeffrey Tambor took the stage at Sunday night's Emmys to accept the award for Best Actor in a Comedy Series, he made a plea.
I would not be unhappy were I the last cisgender male to play a female transgender on television.
Tambor plays a transgender woman in the Amazon show Transparent. He's one of many in a list of cisgender male actors to play transgender women, including Eddie Redmayne in The Danish Girl, Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club. Shekinah Nafak is a transgender actress, performance artist, and activist, and she works in the Hulu comedy series Difficult People, playing the character Lola.
Lola. And yeah, I'm trans.
Okay.
Oh, is it okay, Mr. Biological Essentialist? Do I have your cisgendered permission to be who I am? And you know what else? Bush did 9/11 and jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
Difficult person in the show. Is she difficult here in the studio? We'll find out. Shekinah Nafak, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, this is a fascinating discussion, but also a frustrating discussion. I have watched in my lifetime Tom Cruise win an Oscar for being a disabled man in Born on the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. Eddie Redmayne win an Oscar for being a disabled man in the movie about Stephen Hawking. Mm-hmm. Hilary Swank mm-hmm. winning an Oscar for being a disabled woman in the boxing movie that Clint Eastwood produced. This is a very difficult subject for getting disabled actors employed. How do you think the difficulty has manifested itself for trans people? Why is it difficult? And why do you think it relates maybe to my own frustrations?
I think that's actually a really great intersection to point out. One of the common things that people bring up a lot is the question of like blackface and minstrelsy and the ways that actors of color weren't given the opportunity to play their own parts for many, many years in Hollywood. I think opening the conversation up to include actors with disabilities is really helpful, actually, because the more we see how media can actually invisibilize a marginalized community while attempting to tell their story is important.
But there's also this bias, I think, that you know, people in the Academy or people in the Emmy world will say, whoa, Tambor really pulled off that stretch,
right,
which is exactly what happens with disability. Mm-hmm. Hillary played a quadriplegic in this amazing way, that somehow is a skill of acting, mm-hmm. whereas people in the experience also bring something to it.
Right. You know, Jen Richards pointed this out recently on Twitter. She talked about how while we praise like the virtuosic performance of a non-trans actor playing a trans role, what we're missing is the nuance and lived experience that an actual trans actor might bring to the part.
You don't devalue Jeffrey Tambor's performance, do you? What did you think of what he said?
You know, it's tricky because on one hand, I'm in the industry, and so I understand the long upward road that we're on trying to get fair representation. And on the other hand, I'm a trans person who feels insulted by the role. So it's
insulted
tricky.
That a cisgender male introduced millions of people to this experience through a very successful show called Transparent.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I don't want to badmouth the show. The show has a lot of merit. It's funny. He does great work as an actor. But when I watch it, I just see drag. I don't see a trans woman. I feel like I know trans women of Jeffrey's age. You know, I've transitioned alongside many of them who transitioned later in life. And so I just see them being erased by him being there. It's tricky.
It's a good moment though.
Yeah, it's a really fraught moment, and these conversations are important to create change.
Well, if you see any sign that the iceberg is melting for actors with disabilities, let me know. I'd love for Daniel Day-Lewis not to win another Oscar for playing a disabled person.
Well, you know, I have more experience working in the New York theater community than I do in Hollywood. But I know that the recent Deaf West production of Spring Awakening here on Broadway.
I love that.
It was incredible, right? And Ali Stroker had this really great part, and she's an actress with a disability. We have a recurring actor on Difficult People who is in a wheelchair, Shannon DeVito, and she's hysterical, and she's been on both seasons. So there are people who are conscious about the lack of representation who are doing work to make headway.
Shekinah Nafak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can see Shekinah Nafak playing Lola in the Hulu series Difficult People. And season two right now?
That's right. All season right. Two is streaming the whole thing. You can binge it. Go for it.
In an era of great uncertainty, as the present moment seems to be, what is the best system for making change? People may treasure their freedom, but that doesn't mean they value a democratic government with noisy legislatures and squabbling lawmakers. Such governments can be manipulated into outrageous votes, like the Brexit episode in the UK that millions say they now regret, or the macho I'll do it my way Filipino president Rodrigo Duterte. To Larry Diamond, a professor at Stanford University, democracy's messiness may be a liability in a time when large groups of people want stability and some government they can count on being the same tomorrow as it was today. In such an environment, are the Dutertes and Donald Trumps and Vladimir Putins favored? Diamond has found that 27 countries experienced a breakdown in democracy between 2000 and 2015, while authoritarian governments have become increasingly emboldened and locked down.
We've been in a global recession of freedom and democracy in the world for a number of years, going back 10 years. It's been a relatively mild one. But in the last 2 to 3 years, with the setbacks to democracy in crucial countries, Thailand, Turkey, now you see this thug and autocrat has been elected in the Philippines. It's been gathering steam, and Russia, China, Iran, they're all trying to take advantage of this to promote authoritarian values. On the other hand, the majority of states in the world today are still democracies. There's no broad demand for authoritarian reversal in Latin America, even in post-communist European states. Most of them remain quite clearly democratic. And I spent a lot of time, John, looking at public opinion data from all over the world. And in large parts of the world, most strikingly Africa, which has the lowest average income of any region of the world, there's still broad demand for freedom and democracy. It's just not what their leaders are supplying.
Is it the case that in the 21st century, the decline of democracy's appeal, as you write about it, coincides with a decline also in the robustness and relevance of national nation states, that nation states have a limited ability to control matters, just as democracies have a limited ability to control matters? What's that going to mean 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now?
Well, it's a profound question, John, which Europe is struggling with in a very palpable and possibly trailblazing way. You've seen the British just vote recently to exit the European Union because they felt they were losing control. And I think a lot of the current wave of protectionist sentiment in the United States and elsewhere around the world has to do with the sense that people are losing control over their economic policy, losing control of their lives. There have always been challenges to making democracy work. There's always been a challenge of plutocrats in the 19th century or billionaires now trying to get special access to politics and funneling excessive amounts of money into politics. It requires a constant vigilance and attentiveness to reform. So I think we need to find innovative ways to empower people at different levels and to ensure that there is, accountability and responsiveness of government to the popular will.
Are Americans players in all of this? I mean, if you look at this year's election campaign, it's possibly hard for America to point to itself as an example of a healthy democracy where the people are interested in the kinds of freedoms that were talked about, you know, in the era of Abraham Lincoln or FDR or JFK or even Ronald Reagan.
Well, I think we should wait until the outcome of this election to draw that conclusion. I think that America has declined as a model and a source of admiration in the world democratically. There's no question about that, partly because of the influence of money in politics, partly because of the rise of anti-immigrant and I would even say racist sentiments that have filtered into this presidential campaign. But on the other hand, John, as I travel around the world, what I find everywhere I go is intense interest in the American presidential election and a strong recognition by diverse peoples around the world that, as Madeleine Albright has said during her time as Secretary of State and after, and other American leaders such as Ronald Reagan, we are the indispensable nation. And Democrats around the world know that and wish for a revival and rejuvenation of American democracy and a reaffirmation of our basic principles.
Finally, Larry, and you possibly are a great person to ask this question. If Plato himself was looking down on what was going on in the world right now, he would say, you silly, silly people, you didn't listen to me. What you need is a leadership class that's going to manipulate things like the economy and the essential sort of political order, and people will live under that in a state of grace, as I predicted. And you've not taken my advice at all.
There are very few countries that have wound up with a platonic, if I can use your reference, authoritarian ruler or authoritarian leadership and managed to maintain that sense of benevolence, concern for the common good, and good governance. Singapore is really pretty close to the only one I can think of. You're much more likely to get a Hugo Chavez or a Robert Mugabe or a Karimov, the absolute ruler who just died in Uzbekistan after running his country into the ground. If you opt for authoritarian rule and surrender the accountability that free and fair elections bring and the discipline and constraint that independent courts and media bring, you're much more likely and almost inevitably will wind up with a tyrant rather than a platonic, benevolent autocrat.
Larry Diamond is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of The Spirit of Democracy. He's a professor at Stanford University. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
In medieval Europe, the Roman Catholic Church once was the economy. Its wealth controlled and competed with feudal princes for power. The industrialized economy created new wealth that did not rely on the church, and suddenly, being part of the church wasn't the only way to do as the Romans did. But the secular scientific world has not eliminated the church from the economy even today. Faith-based groups in the U.S. represent $1.2 trillion, according to a study from Georgetown University. That's more than the top 10 U.S. tech companies, more than Google, Apple, and Amazon combined. Brian Grimm is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and co-author of the Georgetown study called The Socioeconomic Contributions of Religion to American Society. Brian, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's great to be with you today.
So what does that mean, $1.2 trillion? Is that a kind of tax-free shadow economy? Is it new wealth? How would you evaluate that $1.2 trillion?
Well, that $1.2 represents the contribution of faith to American society. A lot of that money is actually taxed because religious organizations, their main cost is employing people, and the people pay employment tax, Social Security tax, unemployment tax. So it's not – you can't really classify it as tax-free. But there's three categories in that total sum. One is the activities of congregations where all that money is brought in locally, spent locally, and benefits local economies, both in services and in direct spending, everything from flowers to sound systems for congregations. The second are religious institutions. Those are national charities, faith-based universities, and also other kinds of institutions like hospitals. And the third category is one that people don't often think about, but it's either faith-based business, such as the halal and kosher industries, or faith-friendly businesses, such as Tyson Foods, which hires a force of chaplains to take care of the employees. They're multi-faith employees, so it's sort of like having chaplains in a hospital. The business itself has chaplains in the business.
Is the Jesuit Georgetown University a part of this calculation?
That's right. Georgetown's part of that, as are many faith-based, like Brandeis here in New York, many universities across the country. It doesn't count universities such as Harvard or Princeton that were started as faith-based universities and became secular.
So the Catholic University would sure be in there.
Sure, Catholic University.
Bob Jones University.
That's right. And really hundreds of small faith-based universities like Messiah College are included in that. And then it includes, I was mentioning the business category, groups such as the Knights of Columbus, which have nearly $100 billion worth of life insurance in force, taking care of widows and orphans in the modern age.
So that explains the huge number. What does it say about the character of Americans? Is this just a kind of
accidental economy that has grown out of habits that are centuries old in some cases?
No, it's a very active economy. So people every day take their faith to work with them. It's part of who they are. There's an estimated 187 million American adults who are active in religion in the United States, not counting their kids. So it's part and parcel of who many people are. And part of this is, I really found the most surprising part of the study being how active congregations are. There's 344,000 religious congregations across the U.S. of every religion and denomination. And those congregations are doing everything from providing mental health care to HIV/AIDS ministries to helping people find jobs. And another surprising finding from the study is that there are four times as many congregations that people identify as places to go see art and architecture as there are museums in the whole United States. So, you know, if you walk up and down the streets of, you know, Fifth Avenue or, you know, anywhere here in New York City, you know, you're seeing lots of magnificent religious structures that you could say are in competition and outpacing some of the visits to museums.
What's the breakdown of wealth that goes to more modern evangelical institutions versus the old mainline churches? And then, of course, there's the homegrown Mormon church, which is very much an American phenomenon and has a huge amount of wealth associated with the West.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you've described are the findings of the study, that these activities represented by the dollar figure we have are not confined to just one group. You began talking about the Catholic Church. I mean, Catholic Church is a big player with more adherents than any other single denomination. Then groups like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormons, are very active. So they don't have a professional clergy. So many of, you know, everybody's volunteer, like Mitt Romney, he was a local, what they call bishop or a pastor of a church, and that's all volunteer. And you find many of the volunteers being from the business world. The founder of JetBlue, he said he's also Mormon, and he said he learned everything he needed to make a successful company during his years as a missionary. So that's an example of how faith contributes to the economy, because you have local congregations, local missions, international missions. Tim Kaine, candidate for vice president, he served a Jesuit mission. So these religious experiences contribute to, you know, who people are, how they approach business, how they approach the economy.
Would you say that the power associated with this economic figure is bigger than the political power that is attempted to be thrown about during an election year, particularly from right-wing religious organizations? Does the money translate into political power, and is it across all denominations and all parties, or is it just in one sliver?
It's diverse. So in that figure are large black congregations, historically black churches. So you have, you know, a wide spectrum of political belief represented by these figures. Mainline denominations, by surveys, tend to be more on the leaning left. Conservative evangelicals tend to lean right. But in that figure is all of these different groups are coming in, and Catholics sort of go, you know, lean both ways, you could say. And then you have the Jewish, large Jewish population, a growing Muslim population, and all of these represent different, you know, attitudes and beliefs, political beliefs. So it doesn't translate into the, you know, the old moral majorities. You know, mm-hmm, it's not sure. Just a single sure. Block, but it's having influence on people, you know, across the spectrum.
Brian Grimm is president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and co-author of the study, The Socioeconomic Contributions of Religion to American Society. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
This is Cheryl from Arlington, Texas. I'm a regular donor to our church's soup kitchen, where we feed the working poor and the homeless in our immediate neighborhood. I have seen good work come from helping the homeless, but have also seen a segment of the population that has learned to take advantage of these types of programs and enjoy a free meal while they and their children sit at table and text on their smartphones.
So what's your piece of the faith-based economy? From Little Rock, Arkansas, I donate regularly to my church, and the funds are used locally and worldwide for various ministerial construction, maintenance, and relief efforts. The most recent example was the provisioning of tools and other support for relief efforts in the flooded areas of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. From Austin, Texas, Never. Faith can no more benefit a community than a belief in the tooth fairy. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Subscribe to The Takeaway podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI. Public Radio International.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.